I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about a place that every child and every adult with a little bit of child still in her or him loves, the zoo. We're going to talk today about the zoo and conservation. We'll discuss this important subject with three guests from the Indianapolis Zoo: Dr. Rob Shoemaker, Vice President of Conservation and Life Sciences, Heather Grisham, Director of Education, and John Glessing, Public Relations Director. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the zoo and conservation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got a great group of guests today, all of them from one of my favorite places, the Indianapolis Zoo. Starting with Dr. Rob Shoemaker, who is the Vice President of Conservation and Life Sciences at the zoo. Rob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. Heather Grisham, who is the Director of Education at the zoo. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having us. It's a pleasure.
Certainly. It's good to have you here as well. And John Glessing, who is the Director of Public Relations, or is a Public Relations Director. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thank you.
Certainly. It's good to have you here. Well, I want to start a little bit. Why don't we talk about, and Rob, I'll start with you. What is the zoo doing in terms of conservation? Can you give us an overview on those efforts? And then from there, we'll drill down as to why that's important.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. Probably the most important first thing to say is our mission statement. And the Indianapolis Zoo empowers people and communities locally and globally to advance animal conservation. That's the number one thing that drives all of our decisions and all of our planning and all of our programs. And so we accomplish that in a variety of different ways. Probably the way that most everyone is familiar with is the informal efforts that we carry out on zoo grounds to educate people about animals and conservation and cultivate a passion for them about the animals in our care. And I know Heather can talk a lot more about that as we get into the topic. But that's the informal part of education or conservation education, interactions with animals. I'll give you a great example. When people come to the zoo and they can, for example, have a little budgie land on their shoulder and eat from their hand, or offer something to a giraffe, and a giraffe bends down and reaches out their 18-inch long purple tongue to take a piece of carrot out of a visitor's hand when a keeper's standing there. Those are the kinds of things that really resonate with not just kids, but anybody who's visiting the zoo and engaging with our animals. So those are powerful things that help us compel people towards conservation decisions and changing their attitude in a positive way about conservation. So that's probably a million people a year plus that have those kinds of experiences at the zoo. Then there is the type of conservation work that we support in the wild. I'm so pleased that you're asking us to talk about this today, because frankly, this is the hidden part of the zoo that most people don't know about, and it's so important to us, and we're happy to talk about it. Right now, we have at least 10 different programs that we're supporting throughout the world, ranging from support to fieldwork in Madagascar to Tanzania to Borneo. you name it, all across the globe, we're providing support and expertise to help scientists and conservationists who are doing their work in the field to protect everything from orangutans to elephants. And then the third piece that I'm hoping a number of your visitors are aware of is the Indianapolis Prize. And the Indianapolis Prize is the world's leading award for animal conservation, and it's provided once every 2 years to outstanding is not the right word. It's beyond that. It's someone who's changing the world. It's as simple as that. And last cycle, our recipient was Dr. Stephen Amstrup, who's helping to save polar bears in the wild. Before that was Ian Douglas Hamilton, who's saving African elephants. Our next cycle culminates with our prize gala in 2014. We don't yet know who the recipient will be.
Who selects the recipient?
Well, we have a multi-layered process, so we know it's very objective and that there's lots of informed opinions. Right now, I'm chairing the committee that is winnowing down our initial very, very big list of nominees to a smaller subset. And this fall, that subset will go to the jury, and the jury will then select the recipient of the prize who will receive that award in 2014.
How large is the, and I'll move on to the others in a second, but how large is that subset that you will move on to the jury?
Well, the very final subset is six individuals.
Okay.
And we'll have the recipient and five finalists, and all of them will be present and all will be represented at the gala event in the fall of 2014.
And what will they win?
Well, the recipient wins the Lilly Medal, which is given only to the prize recipients, and they also get a check for $250,000.
Not a bad day's work.
That's not bad. Not bad. So.
Yeah. And Heather, I think Rob set you up a little bit by talking about the educational efforts.
Sure.
Could you talk a little bit about the kind of educational outreach, how you try to emphasize the importance of conservation with particularly the children who come through the zoo?
Sure, absolutely. Conservation's at the core of all of our educational programming. I don't know, you may have seen our conservation station at local festivals. We go to the Earth Day Festival, as well as the 500 Festival Kids Day, in addition to being on zoo grounds. I think the message for Conservation Station, it's an interactive exhibit for children that helps teach them some really simple things that they can do to help protect animals in the wild. I don't know if you've seen, we have these larger-than-life games. We have one that's a six-foot-tall tropical topple. It's like Jenga. And it's one that it's hard to miss when we actually go out like to these different festivals because it's very attention getting. But it's a really easy way to teach kids about the interconnectivity of animals and different, you know, ecosystems. And in that, if you take one piece out, you know, the whole thing comes tumbling down. And so it's a great visual for kids, and it leaves them it's a very important message that we leave with them. But most importantly, at all of these different events, at the Conservation Station events especially, like I said, we teach children some very simple things that they can do in their everyday life to actually help protect animals in the wild. That's one component. We also do all kinds of programming. We have distance learning programming. We are one of the first zoos in the country to actually do distance learning programming. We've done video conferencing with countries such as Afghanistan, Mexico, Canada, all across the United States, and have a variety of programs. But again, conservation is at the core of each and every one of those. We have overnight programs where you actually get to come and spend the evening at the zoo, whether that's for Girl Scout troops or even we have different school age groups from the age of probably second grade all the way up to high school.
Yeah, both of my children have spent an overnight at the zoo.
So, well, and it's kind of a misnomer. There's not a lot of, you sleep at the zoo, but there's not a lot of sleeping going on.
No.
But, so they're overnight programs. We actually have workshops, too. So there are all kinds of ways that we actually present conservation messaging throughout the zoo. And HICS, the education department at the zoo, which is it's called the HICS Institute, mm-hmm. we're responsible for, especially in the summertime, all the many of the chats that you see on zoo grounds. Mm-hmm. So we educate people in a variety of ways, but conservation is at the core of each and every program that we do.
And how important, Rob, as the director of the public relations efforts, is that to the outreach that the zoo does?
Well, it's critical, and it's really what we're all about. Heather mentions, you know, going out on zoo grounds. One thing that sets us apart, I think, from a lot of zoos around the country is our interactive experiences. So when you talk about coming and touching a shark or being underwater with dolphins or racing a cheetah, those are fun things that families can associate with. It certainly makes a lasting impression, but as Rob mentioned, at the core of all of that messaging, and Heather with her chats, it's about conservation. It's about education. So you think of Indianapolis Zoo, and you think, oh, fun. Hopefully you think fun, family-friendly, good play outside, warm day, summertime. And that's all true, and we love that. Mm-hmm. But right underneath the surface for us, it's about are we educating?
There's some learning going on there as well. We are talking about the zoo and conservation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Or you can do as this listener named Terry did. You can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter. She says, please ask when they plan to free the dolphins from that dingy old cement tank. Have you ever seen them swim free, chasing an ocean wave, leaping into the sunlight? The sun, the landlocked Indy dolphins never see the fresh air they never breathe. Who wants to take that one? Rob?
Sure, I'm happy to address that. I don't think there's anything I could say to Terry that would change her opinion. She has a strong view that obviously dolphins should not be in a zoo or anywhere else. I would point out that an example of one dolphin that we're very pleased and proud that we have is a male named Taz, who actually was stranded in the wild and we rescued. He would have faced certain death. He was lost as an infant and found on a sandbar not far away from dying. And he came to us as an infant, and we've nursed him back to health, and he's lived with us now for a couple of years, and he's doing spectacularly well. So I respect the fact that there are people with different opinions, but I also am very proud of the fact that our marine mammal staff does an extraordinary job with our dolphins, and we're very proud to have them and very proud of the care they receive.
How often do you get questions like that? There are people who think, that who question the idea itself of a zoo, that animals shouldn't be caged or put in any way. How often do you have to deal with that, John?
We get the occasional comment if it's on our Facebook page or through an email system or cycle. But as Rob mentioned, it's we're very proud of what the stories we have to tell. And we see a lot of our collection, our animal collection, as ambassadors to the wild. I think zoos in general, all over the world, their goal is, again, to educate the public and the animals through a variety of circumstances. We have many examples, not only Taz, but a stranded walrus, a rescued sea lion, and many others, examples of animals that were rescued from the wild that would not be with us if they hadn't been rescued. And they're now in an environment where they have, I think, a very comfortable life, a good life, and they are, in turn, helping educate, and as Rob mentioned, over 1 million visitors a year about animal conservation, about the importance of animals hopefully being able to live and thrive and survive in the wild.
We've gotten another email question from a listener. It says, where do the giraffes go in the winter? Do they have a barn? Do they ever come out in the snow? I think this is a younger listener, obviously. Rob, I'll throw that one to you.
Sure. Well, the answer is yes, they have a barn, and it's a very tall barn.
And, I would think it would have to be.
Right. And it is a bit surprising. Giraffes are a lot more cold-tolerant than people might think. They don't need tropical temperatures all year long. They're perfectly comfortable when it gets cooler. Now, they're certainly not cold-weather animals. Mm-hmm. But they
can't. What's the bottom line? For, I mean,
I think we don't let any indoor temperatures get much below the 50. fees for them.
Okay.
Before
and they don't go out then, obviously.
Well, they do. They do.
You send them out when it's 20?
Well, they'll
20
have
below?
No, not 20 below. But they have a choice of whether or not they can go out at different times of the year, even into the cold weather. They can go out or stay in the warm barn. The one thing that we have to be very careful about are the conditions of the ground. If it's very slick and muddy or icy, then we don't allow them out because that would present a potentially dangerous situation
for
them.
Yeah, I would think a fall would be very dangerous.
Right. They just don't handle those kind of conditions well, unlike lots of other animals that do just fine in icy weather, like walrus or polar bears.
Yeah, real quickly, John.
You mentioned the barn where the giraffes stay. If you're on the train ride at the zoo and you go past their evening core, their building, you'll see a very unique door that allows them to come in and out, as Rob mentioned. It's very tall and very thin.
We are talking about the zoo and conservation. My guests are Rob Shoemaker, Heather Grisham, and John Glessing, all from the zoo. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the zoo and conservation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Rob Shoemaker, who is the VP of Conservation and Life Sciences at the zoo, Heather Grisham, who is the Director of Education, and John Glessing, who is the PR director there. Heather, I'm going to ask a little bit, what is the sort of the most difficult concept for kids to grasp when it comes to the conservation education efforts you're doing? What's the hardest thing to sort of convey to them?
I would have to say, I think one of the challenges that we face, especially, for instance, the polar bear. We have a game called Polar Bear Plunge. I think it's really challenging for kids because obviously they've seen a polar bear at the zoo, but it's a challenge for them to understand what they face and, you know, the challenges they face in the wild. And so I think the hardest job that we have is helping connect them in a way that perhaps, you know, they wouldn't normally think of. And that's why we find, at least in our world, games are a really good way to do that. But trying to help them connect to a species that they may not necessarily understand the challenges that the species faces in the wild, I think that's our most important job.
What are the ones they're most fascinated by?
Oh, I mean, I think a lot of times it's the iconic species. They love the polar bear. I think that's why Polar Bear Plunge was a huge hit. That's a life-size game like Don't Break the Ice that we have that we play with kids to help teach them about the plight of the polar bear. Polar bear for sure. I think elephants. You can't go wrong with elephants. I think giraffe. We've already talked about the giraffe. So a lot of the iconic species, I think kids have really, they're fascinated by race a cheetah. I think any kid who's actually gotten to race against the lights, you know, at the zoo and know that their money is going towards helping protect cheetahs in the wild, I think that's a really compelling experience for kids. So a lot of the iconic species that you would think of.
What are the ones that you really have to struggle and say, okay, you should care about this, you really should, and it's a tough sell?
Yeah. You know, I would have to say, because they surprise me in many cases. You know, we had someone a few years ago at the, you know, for the prize, and he was he specialized in frogs, and you know, I remember thinking at the time, you know, having to tell his story, I thought, oh wow, you know, this is a challenge. But I mean, you'd be amazed at what resonates with kids. I mean, especially even with frogs. I mean, they experience those, and if they're taking a walk in the woods, they may come across. So I think it's surprising, but. Again, I think that's where we rely heavily on areas of interest for them. Playing games with kids, that's an avenue that they definitely understand and it resonates with them. So finding a way to actually present it in a meaningful way is a way, even if you might think of a species that may not ring their bell right off the bat. I think we can always find a way to help them understand that animal.
We are talking about conservation in the zoo here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Taylor, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
First off, I'd like to mention that I used to work for you guys at the zoo. I was public safety. And I learned very quickly there that the animals who think that they're going to be graceful, like the big cats, they are the biggest klutzes in the world. I have never seen so many animals fall off rocks, smash in the glass pails. It's really quite hilarious. But yeah, these guys do just incredible work, and you can never say enough about them. My question was, I know there is a orangutan exhibit going in and set to be completed next year, I think. What's next after that? Is there another big exhibit coming, or is our biomes going to be tweaked and animals moved and stuff like that?
Thanks very much for the question, Taylor. We'll try to get you an answer. Well, who would like to take that one? Rob?
Sorry, I'm just reeling a little. Let us get the orangutan facility open before we move on to something else.
Amen.
Actually, I'm so pleased, Taylor, that you asked about this really important project. This is a massive undertaking, and we're in the final months of construction right now. Anybody who's been to the zoo recently couldn't possibly have missed it, because it's really in the heart of the zoo, taking up several acres and rising about 150 feet into the sky. This new facility will be unlike any other orangutan complex in the United States or the world. I think it will provide a premier home for our orangutans and a premier place for visitors to learn about them and be inspired to care more about them. And it will open in May of 2014 for visitors, but we're planning to move the orangutans in there as soon as the construction is done, which will be a bit earlier so that they can learn everything about the new facility before we allow in all of our anxious visitors.
And start spooking them with people looking at them and all of that.
Yeah, and we have no definitive major announcements after the orangutan facility, at least that we're making today.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me then take Taylor's question, turn it into kind of a wish list one. What species that the zoo doesn't currently have would you really like to have there? Rob?
Oh, wow.
Tough one.
I know that this is a tough one. My kids are voting for narwhals, which we're not likely to have, but the Arctic whales with the giant unicorn horn in the front of their head. Wow. I will tell you one that I think of, and again, we have no plans to do this, but I would love it if we had American alligators, simply because they're a phenomenal conservation success story. And it is sometimes...
In what way?
Well, it can be a challenge to identify conservation successes, because it's frequently an uphill battle. But American alligators were in very, very tough shape in our own country, and with strict laws and excellent enforcement of those laws for both the alligators and their habitat, they have come roaring back, and it has been a phenomenal success story for American alligators, even in our own country, that not too many years ago we thought, wow, we could lose American alligators in the United States. So I would love it if we were able to highlight a little bit more some of the remarkable conservation stories, that success stories that are out there.
We are talking about the zoo and conservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Craig, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I have a question.
Certainly.
Right across the street from the zoo to the south, across Washington Street, is a huge chunk of land that used to be an industrial complex, and it isn't anymore. The city is casting around for some use for that facility. Has anybody thought about giving that or buying that property for the zoo, connecting it to the main body of the zoo with tunnels under Washington Street or over the top with gerbil tubes, thereby probably doubling the land area of the zoo? You're landlocked as it is. You're not going to be expanding into the White River. You're probably not going to be going west into Hallville. You're not going to be moving the Marriott Hotel. So why not grab that land and expand the zoo greatly? Has anybody thought of that? How much money would be involved? You know, why don't we expand what we have rather than worrying about turning Indianapolis into the cricket capital of the world?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Craig. John Glessing.
It's certainly something that is on our radar. We are well aware of that big land on the other side of Washington Street, and it has come up in conversations. The X factor is the old dollar, the almighty dollar. We have our hands full right now with the orangutan construction, that exhibit, in our kind of long-term planning. We do have to think about what is next for the zoo and how we might want to grow. So has it been talked about? Has it been explored? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. But the other reality in front of us today is we are the largest zoo in the United States that receives no direct tax support. So the money we have coming in is entirely through memberships, people coming to the gate, concessions, donors, gifts, and the money that we have coming in to execute our operating budget today handles the land that we have.
How large a lift would it be how much would it cost to acquire that land across there? Do you have any ballpark idea?
I have no idea. I really don't.
And then that raises the question, the other point of Craig's call. I mean, without something like that, I mean, do you have any room to expand anywhere else, or are you trapped pretty much in the space that something, you know, in terms of the question I just asked about whether there are dream species that you'd like to have there, dream exhibits, mm-hmm. is, you know, for that to happen, would something else have to go?
I think we are landlocked. The caller's correct. We are bordered on four sides with without a whole lot of room to grow. So we have done a really good job in recent years of refurbishing some of the exhibit space. An example would be our encounters area that used to be some of the farm animals that is now our flights of fancy aviary. We had some unused space in the middle of the zoo that is now the orangutan construction site. But we do have to think about where we're going to go next. And again, it's talking about there's a couple of things. Yes, it's money, but it also gets back to Rob's opening statement about our mission. Mm-hmm. And we are about animal conservation. You've seen a transformation, a noticeable one, I hope, in the last decade or so, where we have animals that are literally on the brink of extinction. We're trying to showcase those animals. So we're trying to balance being a family fund institution and education, but also highlighting where the causes are globally that we're really trying to highlight that falls back into our mission.
I presume the zoo is set up as a not-for-profit, right?
Yes.
A 501c3 so that people can make contributions and support the work of the zoo, and therefore, you know, financial success for you means that you want to end up with about a dollar more than you started the year with and have completed. We've gotten a question via Twitter, and if you want to do that or connect with us via Facebook, you can do so at WFYI. It says, what kind of training, education do you need to care for animals at the zoo? Are jobs readily available? Rob.
Thanks, John. You know, it's a wonderful question, and it's one that we hear a lot. The first point is there are jobs available at the zoo in all departments, including the animal care department or life sciences. You can check that on our website at IndianapolisZoo.com or IndyZoo.com also. I think it depends a bit on the institution that you're applying to, but I would say for zoos like the Indianapolis Zoo or any zoo within the Association of Zoos and Aquariums in the United States, the vast majority of animal caretakers have an undergraduate degree in some field like biology or related, zoology, psychology, sometimes anthropology. But that's probably the most important thing to start educationally. But I would stress that if you're interested in the zoo field, unless you have spent time working at a zoo, either as a volunteer or an intern or some opportunity like that, it might be very difficult to know if you have a good perspective on what the job entails. So I would strongly encourage anyone who's interested in working at a zoo, get some experience in a volunteer or internship capacity first to be absolutely sure. And the good thing is it will either tell you straight away that your dad was right and you should go to business school, or it will tell you straight away, boy, you were absolutely right and this is the greatest job you could ever imagine. It's all you really want to do. There's usually nothing very ambiguous in there for most people.
Heather, I'm going to ask you, what's the hardest thing about working at the zoo?
You know, I think it's
funny. And
I'll
ask the flip side of that, too,
yeah.
Which is the best thing, the most exciting. But what's the hardest thing?
Paul Grayson, who's a deputy director of the zoo, when I first started, because I have a teaching background, a teaching and a television background. And so I think I didn't know what I didn't know. And I think one of the hardest things, you know, Paul said to me, you'll know what you need to know in 2 years. And I've been at the zoo for 6, and he came to me after 2 years, and he said, so how do you feel? And I said, Paul, you're never going to know what you need to know. You know, there's so many things, there's so many species that we have, there's so many things, and I think that's the most challenging part, I think. I mean, even especially for our educators, because we need to know something about each and every species that we have at the zoo. So in my mind, I don't know, you know, what John thinks, but I feel like, you know, coming in from a different, you know, a different profession, it's a challenge. So, and I think you have to stay on your toes and you know, do your homework. So I think that's probably the most challenging part for me anyway.
What's the best thing?
Oh, you know, I think, and I forget this a lot. I think, you know, we all spend a lot of times in our office, and I think sometimes I forget what a neat place it is to work. You know, sometimes you can be having a really challenging day, and you just take a walk out on zoo grounds, and you may see a really, really cool experience. Like I happened upon, we have it's called the Flamingo, you know, Flamingo Mingle now. And it was just kind of a stressful day, and I walked out and I watched all these camp kids, and they were having their hair kind of, you know, tussled by these flamingos, and this went on for probably 20 minutes. It was just a really, really cool experience. So I think sometimes we forget, you know, what a really cool place it is that we work, and I think those moments are really, you know, magical moments, and those happen every day at the zoo, and I think it's just being able to, you know, partake in those and enjoy those every day.
We are talking about the zoo and conservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can also send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. John, you mentioned earlier that the Indianapolis Zoo is the largest that doesn't receive, you know, government support. Obviously, a couple hundred miles to the west, or a little more than that. We've got another example. St. Louis Zoo is sort of the opposite model. They're entirely government supported, and therefore admissions free, and all of that. You know, are there other zoos that have models like that that you would envy or you would think might work well here in Indianapolis?
You know, I've been with the zoo now less than 2 years, so like Heather, I'm still learning something new every day. So my frame of reference is what the Indianapolis Zoo offers, and I come from the for-profit world before coming to the not-for-profit world. So,
where were you before?
I was with locally based Hat World Inc. In retail, of all things. So quite a career change to come to the zoo. But what has blown me away in a good way since day one was the business model that the Indianapolis Zoo operates under. It's leadership, it's diversity when it comes to funding, whether it's memberships, again, gate admission and things of those along those lines, but how it all weaves seamlessly into really the messaging that goes on here, and its reputation, and you know, you can hear about paying for parking and you paying for admission, and we hear some of those comments, but I think they're pretty quickly absorbed when they hear about how independent we are and the good messaging and education programming that comes out of here. I think the greater good is definitely served under the business model that we have.
But does it cost you the opportunity to serve people who just don't have the means to get to the zoo?
We do address that on days like today, of all things. We have what's called Community Tuesday, where a normal admission to the zoo is $16.95. Today it's just $8. We encourage families that if they can, a zoo membership is your best value. If you're going to come 3-4 times a year, in the long run, it's worth having a membership. And again, all that money goes to the operating budget. So we offer online discounts. There are group rates. We certainly extend a great discount to school groups, whether it's field trip season in the spring, times of year like that. There are affordable ways to come to the zoo.
How large is the zoo's annual budget?
I think it's in excess of $22 million.
So it's not an insignificant lift. And do you start from zero, or do you have an endowment?
We have an endowment, somewhere in the mid to upper $20 million range, so not huge.
We are talking about the zoo and conservation here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Rob Shoemaker, Heather Grisham and John Glessing, all of them from the zoo. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the zoo and conservation today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Rob Shoemaker, who is the Vice President of Conservation and Life Sciences at the zoo, and his colleagues also from the zoo, Heather Grisham, who is the Director of Education, and John Glessing, who is the PR Director. We're talking about other zoos and the way they function. I'm going to take that in a somewhat different direction and just say, other than your own zoo, what are your favorite zoos to visit? I'll start with Rob.
Boy, that's such a tough question. I would say, well, it's a little bit odd for me because not only do I have good friends at other zoos, so I like visiting the Lincoln Park Zoo, for example, to see my friend Steve.
Mm-hmm. Steve's probably not listening, so he won't be hurt.
Oh, I know, but he's still a good guy.
Yeah.
There are also animals that I have worked with that have moved to other zoos, and I love going there to mm-hmm. see them and see how they're doing. I guess the end result of that is there isn't one particular zoo that I particularly think of as the place I like to visit, but there are specific exhibits or specific people or specific animals that I get excited to see. So there's something intriguing and exciting for me at any zoo that I visit.
Heather, how about you?
I have to say the Lincoln Park Zoo. It's so cool because it's right there in the heart of the city. We would typically walk there. I had family in Chicago, and I have to say the primate exhibit there, I think, was a really cool experience, at least for me.
Okay. And John?
Anywhere my kids enjoy going is my favorite zoo. Now, we've been to San Diego, St. Louis, of course, Columbus, Cincinnati. They all have something to offer. I had the pleasure of going to the Phoenix Zoo last mm-hmm. fall, about a year ago at this time, and they have an orangutan exhibit. So I was on a beeline to that exhibit when I got there because I knew what was coming here to kind of look at it. And that was an impressive place, too. Just I liked Phoenix a lot.
We are talking about the zoo and conservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Rob, you mentioned, you know, the fact that you form these associations with animals that go to other zoos. And as you were talking, I was listening, thinking, boy, that's a part of the job I really didn't think about. I mean, it's you know, for many people, the relationship they have with their pets, for example, is, you know, a very, very deep one. You have that experience many times over. I would think that would be a difficult part of the job, having to say goodbye, either because the animals move on to some other situation or because they die.
I agree with you. That was going through my mind when Heather was talking about the hardest part or the best part of working at a zoo. I think it's slightly different for me, and we work with a living collection, and in the majority of cases, our lifespans will be more than the animals we work with, even if they. If we were there to see them being born or hatched. So I would say, at least for me, and I suspect for most people that focus on the animal side of the zoo, it's really an interesting contrast because you have these spectacular times in your career where you see an animal born or you see an animal be a successful mother or you see an animal mature, some wonderful success in that regard. and it just doesn't get any better. And then, of course, you have the sad part, which is the natural end as animals age and die. And it can be very, very, very difficult. But I think it's that balance that you learn after being in the profession for a number of years.
We are talking about the zoo and conservation today on No Limits. You can connect with us by phone by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We had a listener named Dave who didn't want to go on the air, but said, what state agency regulates private exhibitors of large exotic cats? Anyone got an answer to that, Rob?
Yeah, it's not a state agency. It's a federal agency. It's USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture. They have a very large network of inspectors. Most are veterinarians, not all, but most, who inspect any USDA-licensed facility, and you must be USDA-licensed, for example, to have big cats or so on, which I'm certainly not advocating, but meaning to have big cats as a private individual. But that's the answer to who regulates that and who inspects that.
We are talking about the zoo and conservation today on No Limits. Bob, welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon to
good afternoon.
You, and good afternoon to your host, your guest.
Thanks.
I would like to say I think that it would be, this is probably back to maybe a couple of callers ago when they were talking about the expansion, and it's like almost like he took the words right out of my mouth when he was talking about using that land on the other side of the zoo. I basically think that it would be a very profitable move for the zoo. And I'm almost certain that, you know, somewhere or another, that someone could build, you know, some funds around that, even if not they get some kind of donor or investment, or, you know, because I think not only the zoo is educational, but it could be a very profitable way for the city and the state to go, or whoever. I mean, is it the Indiana, or was it owned by the Indianapolis or Indiana Zoo?
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Bob. We'll try to figure out an answer to that question. Okay. John, I'll throw that one back to you. I think he's sort of asking also, would it be profitable? Couple of questions there. Would it be profitable for you to expand? And B, if you did have more space, maybe this one goes to Rob, how would you use it?
It would be nice to tag team with Rob on this one. From the standpoint of to grow the zoo, it also means growing our staff. It means growing construction costs to build where you would put these animals, what animals we would get. For example, I think our average monthly grocery bill to feed the animals at the zoo today is in excess of $35,000 a month.
And you don't even have a teenage boy.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you start thinking about expanding, and yes, there's land there, and agreed, it's attractive, and it would certainly, you know, would be nice to bring in more animals and be able to tell the zoo story on a grander scale. It costs money to do that, and you know, with a couple of million dollars still to go with our fundraising goal for the International Orangutan Center, we still have a little bit to go with the space we have in front of us. So all those things about expanding across the street have been discussed, are being looked at, but it takes money, it takes planning.
Well, and I'll throw the second part of that to Rob in a second, but I want to stay with you. How difficult has it been, you know, with an economy that has struggled, that has been, you know, up and down here, to continue working with that model where, it is either got to be, basically, it all comes from private sources, either people coming to the zoo, and entertainment's one of the first things people cut back on when their dollars get tight, or charitable contributions, and that's another thing they scale back when things get tight.
It's always a challenge, and always will be. It always has been, even when in the so-called good times. What we have to do is stay focused on our mission, stay focused on the relationships that we have, the plan that's in front of us. Again, I can't say enough good things about our fundraising staff, about the zoo staff in general, running memberships. It is a team effort. always grown. I mean, if you think about where we've come from, you know, we just celebrated our 25th anniversary in White River State Park in June. And next year will be our 50th anniversary. And for your listeners that can remember the zoo back in those days, just look at how far we've come. And that's come through, again, a great relationship of donors and a great relationship with the city to have in excess, I think, of 36,000 households that are members of the zoo really speaks a lot to who we are and what we stand for.
Rob, I'm going to give you a chance to take, if you had the space across there, how would you use it?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that made the Indianapolis Zoo especially appealing to me was the philosophy that we are not trying to be all things to all people. We are not trying to have the most animals or the most land or any of those types of things. We're trying to do a superb job with a smaller number of species. We're trying to be the best with what we have, and we're not trying to do everything. So I don't frankly have no idea what we would use additional land like that for at this time, but I can absolutely tell you that our focus is to do the absolute best with the species that we have, and it would take a good long discussion, and I know we'd come up with a good idea, but I appreciate so much the enthusiasm that your caller presented and his support for the zoo, and I'm thrilled that he knows he thinks he knows a funder out there who would we'd be happy to hear from that funder. So, but I mostly appreciate the wonderful support from that caller. It's great to hear, and thank you again if you're still listening.
We got a question via tweet from a listener named Jessica, who says, we just finished up National Zookeeper Appreciation Week. What role do zookeepers play in conservation / animal life? I'll throw that one back to Rob.
Wow. Our keepers are the heart and soul of the zoo. They are there 24/7 if necessary, and they live and breathe their passion for caring for the animals that are at our zoo. I don't know how else to say it. I started as a keeper. I worked as a keeper for years and years, and these are folks who have just incredible devotion, incredible endurance, and are remarkably resilient. Well, we couldn't have a zoo without them. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. So I guess the answer is, what part do they play in conservation? I think they play a really crucial part in terms of doing the very frequent and high-quality one-on-one interactions that our visitors have when they want to learn about animals. There's no better person to talk to than one of the keepers at the zoo. And frequently it goes above and beyond that. Many of our keepers are involved with charitable organizations that provide support for conservation causes in the wild. One that comes to mind is conservation support for rhinos. And we have an event put on just by our keeper staff every year that raises thousands of dollars for rhinoceros conservation. It's called Bowling for Rhinos. And they go bowling and get sponsors and raise tons of money. So keepers do a phenomenal job in that regard.
We've gotten a Facebook question. It says, what about Bambi Gate? I never really understood what the Indiana couple that rescued the deer did wrong. Is that just an Indiana law? Then why can people buy exotic animals? Is that different state by state? Rob, I'll throw that one to you.
I'm sorry, I don't know the specifics of the situation.
It was right at the beginning of this year. There was a family that rescued a deer, and it turned out that they had violated some state law. And there was a large controversy at the beginning of the year that dissipated fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. I think everybody sort of said, no, we're not going to.
Well, the one thing I can answer from that question is, yes, states vary in terms of their laws of what animals can be owned privately, and it varies significantly from state to state, sometimes even from city to city within a state. So it's always good to check your local laws and know that you're in compliance.
We've also gotten another Facebook comment from a listener who says he's enjoying today's show, love the questions related to kids and their interest and interaction with the animals. I work for a nonprofit that provides trauma counseling for children impacted by violence. I recently met a young client who was not very talkative until we started talking about animals. Stinky elephants that you can ride, showing me how you ride an elephant and so on. Sometimes we can't appreciate the different ways we are served in our relationship to the creatures with which we share our world. Kudos to you and your guests. Heather, I would think moments like those are the ones that you live for.
Oh, yeah. I think that's, I mean, as educators, I think those are the moments we live for. And I think it's our goal every day, each and every day, through every chat, through every program, to touch and inspire, you know, those kids. I think those are, like, we have an event associated with the prize called Meet a Hero, Be a Hero Day. And I think there are so many cool moments that happen during that event. These are kids who are inspired by all these conservationists. In fact, I think the coolest moment was this little 8-year-old kid, you know, walks in the dolphin gallery that day and saw Rodney Jackson, who studied snow leopards. And he'd seen him on whether it was Discovery or Animal Planet. And to him, he was a rock star. And I think being able to provide those types of moments for kids, whether it be through the prize or through any other educational program that we do, I think that's our goal each and every day.
And in that, I mean, in this case, it's also about the fact that you've got a kid who maybe had some communication issues. Do you find often that interacting with the animals breaks down those barriers?
I think it can. I mean, I think that's every kid is interested in animals. I think that's a level at which we can always communicate with them on. I think we have had those experiences. We partner with Big Brothers Big Sisters, and we're able to put some of those kids actually in the water with dolphins, and I think some pretty cool things happen, and you know, in those instances as well. But I think kids love animals, and I think anytime we can create those moments for them, I think it's a neat opportunity for us.
We've got just a little bit of time left, so I'm going to start with Rob on this one. But in terms of conservation, what is the biggest challenge still confronting the zoo?
Well, I don't know that we have one particular challenge. I think the constant effort for us is to raise awareness and engage people and inspire their interest. I think the biggest challenge for everyone in terms of conservation is making sure that people are aware and informed and inspired to make a positive change. That's not just true for the Indianapolis Zoo. I think that's true for any conservation organization.
And what's the biggest obstacle toward achieving that? I mean, where do people push back?
Well, conservation is not always easy, and sometimes it does mean that you have to make a change in your life or your habits, and sometimes it takes some effort. And so I think that's where it becomes difficult. It's certainly wonderful when you can present something that's an easy option that makes a positive difference. It doesn't impact us too much, but the reality is that sometimes the choices are not so easy, and sometimes the choices do require a bit more effort and do require a change, but those are the ones that can be particularly meaningful.
I think that will have to be the last word. Like Rob Shoemaker, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. Thank you very much for being here. John Glessing, thank you for joining us. And Heather Grisham, all of you from the Indianapolis Zoo, thank you for spending time with us today. You have been listening to No Limits. We will be back on Thursday. I am John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.